agenda in here.
Okay.
Oh, it's the total, yeah. And then. We made that for you. And that's in everyone's folder.
Good.
I got to run Monday because I'm getting it. My vocals.
What? There must have been some duplicates in that. I counted 270 local projects.
Ran out of gas in the presentation.
Over the weekend.
These are what were submitted to.
Okay. Okay.
We have, where we have an official document.
All right. Okay.
There's a, Island Bill, it'd be kind of local.
Okay. Well, that must be what I was.
Yeah.
What I was trying to.
From that report you were counting from.
Uh-huh.
We've had more bills introduced.
Right, okay.
So the 272 would now be 311 bills.
But to, in the end, still 232 requests, so.
Is what we have documentation.
Okay. Good. Good, good, good.
Did some committee tours to.
Right. Oh, like how many? Really?
10 days.
Well, that might be kind of just a present.
Fun facts.
Yeah, fun facts, yeah.
Oh, that's a duplication of what's up here.
Oh, thank you, yeah. 10 days and 109 projects, huh?
Mm-hmm. Left off in morning Rochester for the veterans.
Okay. Sorry. That's all right.
About that.
Yeah, that was pretty close.
Oh. There was something else.
You going to drive home tonight too?
Yeah, you too. You're going to stay up here, aren't you?
No.
Quick meeting, real quick.
So I'm like all packed up this morning.
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, no.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh,
so imagine.
I'm camping. I'm not taking action, I'm just getting information.
Well, the police do?
Well, what I did is I called my AAA, and they called the police.
Oh, really? Well, I didn't know that.
It was Patty.
They don't have to break
them. They're about 15 minutes late.
Hi, Senator. She's really nice.
Who am I?
Where do we sit here?
Oh, we sit down somewhere. I don't know.
How are you?
Deller.
Senator? Senator Metzen, you're over here.
Billy, that's good.
Next to Senator Lisa.
Oh, hi.
That's trouble.
Okay, Senator Langseth, how are you?
You got to switch barbers.
I'm good.
Oh, it keeps growing back. I don't know what to do.
Thank you. How are you? I'm good. Hey, Senator.
Good morning.
Sit down and visit about something.
Everything in program.
Oh, good. Down the phone, but. Yeah. The one I'm going to do.
You don't even have a quorum yet.
Not yet.
That's the chief.
Howdy.
Hey.
How are you?
She'll know.
How are you?
All right.
Hey there.
Sit down. How are you there, Pedro?
Hey, why did they put one of the
Let's get started.
You got one in your pockets?
Well, it'll be a proposal.
I didn't see you on the governor's bill.
Oh, yeah.
Archie, they sent me way over there. Have they got quite a few people on it?
I didn't. I was 1,600 people. And they put their fiscal vote down. I need three more people. Well, both.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I could tell some stories about that, too.
Like I told this Michelle.
I think so, yeah.
Some way. I've been chair
for 10 years. You got a bill doing something like that? Well, I've said that for years.
Democrat. Yeah. I asked to see him. I couldn't see him. Then he gives me less than
half.
So
you get some kind of streamlining bill or something?
And I'm forced to somehow pull it in?
Yeah, I got a little. It is not a big
deal. I love it.
The intent, it's the same.
Good principle. Good for you.
Yes, you should prioritize.
Audio.
Well, you need your testimony. Give me some credit for
it. I'm going to reference you.
Then you'll get all the DFL votes. No.
All these people want to be on bombing
11. Don't show up, yeah.
We can start, yeah. Why don't we call the meeting to order? This is Capital Investment Committee, February 13th, 2012, 6 o'clock, or thereabouts, 6:04. Welcome to this evening's meeting. This will kick off, if you will, the Capital Investment Committee's program agenda for the year. And what we thought, and we will go from tonight, where we are talking a little bit about just the overall financial aspects of capital bonding going on into more specific projects related to the University of Minnesota, MinSCU, state agencies, some local projects, and so on and so forth in subsequent meetings. I think we'll always find, and we're somewhat of an orphaned in the sense that we don't have a so-called regular room. Now, we're having a meeting on Wednesday, if you're not aware of that, Wednesday morning. Is that 8 o'clock?
8:30
Wednesday morning in, I believe, this same room. Yeah, but we'll have to bounce around a little bit because we just don't have that pattern of a regular room down. And I've noted here that a quorum's present, so we can certainly do business, although this is primarily just all about getting information. Just along the way, you may have noted a little sheet of paper in your handout that just kind of talks about how the bonding requests break down this year. Five requests for the University of Minnesota, $169 million, 26 from MinSCU at 278. State agencies in total, 108 requests for 1.17 or so million. Local projects, 93 at 523 million. And that's in your packet if you're so inclined. And David Jensen handed me, and I'm not sure if you have this or not, but during the course of some tours over the course of later this, not necessarily summer, but fall and going on into the winter, We had 10 days in which we toured various parts of Minnesota and saw 109 of these projects on a closer, more local basis. So kind of that's where we are. And again, tonight's all about the financial aspects of bonding and capital investment. And let me just also note a couple of things. A lot of the activity this year is going to be directed by Senator John Peterson, who is vice chair of this committee. And in view of my situation, John will be carrying a lot of water for this committee in terms of leadership, and we welcome that, John, and thank you very much for that. Also, some may not be aware, Julian Plowman, right? Plowman? Okay, Julian Plowman is the new committee of administrator for the Capital Investment Committee, effective, prior to the start of the session. So it's good to have you, Julian. And she's done a great job in terms of preparation and working with on a lot of aspects of this. So why don't we begin? And we've got two individuals, both from management and budget, here tonight to talk about, again, the financial aspects of bonding. The first one is Gay Greider, and she's going to overview with us the whole capital budget process so that we're familiar with that. Gay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us in to speak to you. We appreciate the opportunity. As you indicated, I will be making our first presentation, which just generally overviews the capital budget process, both the process and some of the inherent limitations that come with using bonding proceeds for state capital projects. And then the Assistant Commissioner, Kristen Hansen, will follow with a presentation discussing bonds and our debt capacity.
May I just ask, can you all hear her all right, or if it's just me? Could you maybe get a little closer to the microphone?
I surely will. Thank you, Chairman. The goals of the capital budget process are, by soliciting requests from both local governments and state agencies in a uniform way, to create a standardized description of both state agency and local government capital projects and also their associated costs, so that it can facilitate decision-making and also evaluation by MMB and decision-making by the legislature. We collect and present the information in the submittal to the legislature on January 17th of the information necessary to evaluate and select capital projects, whether they're coming from other state agencies or from local governments. Major capital budgets typically are presented for consideration in even-numbered budget sessions. The even-numbered years are the budgets that actually have a legislative and administrative process for consideration. Capital budgets may also be considered in odd-numbered years, and typically there is a bonding bill of varying sizes adopted in the odd-numbered years. For example, we enacted a $500 million bonding bill last year. Capital budget process is governed by both the state constitution and various state statutes. Article 11, Section 5 of the state constitution, and also a number of state statutes, including Section 16A.11, which requires a preliminary capital budget to be presented on July 15th, which was actually delayed this year because of the state shutdown. That came over in mid-August of 2011, and that just contained the agencies and the local government requests as they existed at that time in preliminary form. Section 16A.86 discusses capital project grants to political subdivisions, and we'll be discussing that a bit further. And then Section 16A.502 discusses non-state commitments to capital projects, including matching requirements. Requirements of the state constitution are four. One is that projects which are funded by state GO bond funds be publicly owned, that the expenditures be capital in nature, namely land and buildings and not of an operating and maintenance nature, that it have a public, not private, purpose, and that the project or a program from which grants will be made are clearly set forth in the rider appropriating the funding. Statutory requirements, to discuss a bit more in detail these statutes that I mentioned a couple of slides previously, Section 16A.11 requires two submissions, one on July 15th, which, as I mentioned, is the preliminary submission. The final budget that is submitted with the governor's recommendation, which was submitted on January 17th this year, since January 15th was over a weekend, the plans must show a six-year horizon, meaning agencies and local governments must show the requests that they're making in this biennium and also what they project in order to complete projects over the next two biennia. The governor's budget shows both his recommendations and the amount of the total requests from agencies and local governments. And then the items in the governor's budget are presented in the priority given by the agency and by local government, local governments requesting grants, regardless of whether he recommended them or not. Section 16A.502.
Can I just interrupt?
Yes.
So if we look at the governor's bill, could we assume that that is an order of some priority?
No. The budget that he presented in the two binders that came over on January 17th, there's a cover page to both the local government requests and also a cover page for each of the agencies, and that shows their priority order.
Okay.
Thank you. The bonding bill does not indicate that priority. Section 16A.502 requires that the total cost of the project must be indicated before the state money can become available. That's a safeguard provided in statute so that the state money doesn't go out the door and then the local government or the agency that's required to have other funding for it discovers it doesn't have the funding and then the project can't be completed. Section 16A.86, which governs capital project grants to political subdivisions, which they're made to local subdivisions through the various agencies. The statute provides that there's an assumption or a presumption that a 50% local match is required, but that can be overridden by the legislature or the governor in the actual bonding legislation. So sometimes, for example, in past riders, you'll see that it requires a 50% match. At times, there's been a 2-for-1 match. At times, the match has been completely dispensed with. The requests that are made to MMB, at least, must state the public purpose that's going to be served, whether new or additional state operating subsidies will be required so that we know whether it has an implication for the operating budget as well, whether the requesting entity has passed a resolution in support of the request, and what their priorities are if they're submitting multiple requests, and whether Department of Administration pre-designed submission has been completed. If they haven't made it at that time and their project is funded, they will have to make a pre-designed submission later unless it's under one of the statutory exemptions. And the reason for the pre-design requirement is so that the Department of Administration can make sure that especially local governments have carefully thought through their project, that they've scoped out all the costs, and that they've actually thought about all the funding and phasing that they will need to do to complete the project. Our basic timeline has already well underway, of course, for this session. Back in April of last year, we issued instructions to both state agencies and local governments for submitting their requests to MMB. Through May and into June, agencies were submitting that information, and we were helping them submit that information in a correct format. They were due on June 25th. We were shooting for the July 15th statutory submission to the legislature, which, of course, we needed to reschedule later because of the state shutdown. Mid-October, is when we ask agencies to be submitting any changes to their projects, changes to their cost data. On December the 1st, we issued our state budget forecast and debt capacity forecast. On January 17th, the governor submitted his 2012 capital budget to the legislature, along with all of the final agency and local government capital requests and all of the cost data, all of the project narratives. We have another budget and debt capacity forecast coming out at the end of February. We can look forward to considering various bonding bills this session, and then perhaps one will be enacted by the end of session. Now, this particular slide is not pertinent this year. It was more helpful last year when I made this presentation. It's describing the process that comes into play in off-year capital budgets, such as was enacted in the special session of last year. There's not a statutory or administrative procedure whereby MMB solicits requests, such as we do in the even-numbered years. So, as it turned out, the governor decided that he did want to submit a capital budget recommendation, which he did. That was followed up by his inviting agencies to come present capital budgets and us, or come present their requests and us, MMB, attempting to elicit more information about those requests. And because that's not a standard bonding year, we did not submit those requests to the legislature. Once the bonding bill is enacted, MMB has an ongoing role in terms of administering these appropriations and grants. We set them up in the state accounting system. We monitor any appropriations that require local match, and we make sure that we have seen and approved the evidence of that local match before we will allow the agency to disperse those funds. We make sure that full funding is satisfied. We, on an ongoing basis, train state agencies and work with local governments to make sure that they understand what the limitations are on the use of bonding funds, both that they're capital in nature and that they must adhere to the strict terms of the description of the project in the legislation. And we also monitor private use in bond finance facilities, which is very important for maintaining the tax-exempt status of our bonds. Private use has become of increasing concern to MMB as, over time, the legislature has begun to appropriate funding for projects that have a public purpose, but they're less of an obvious public purpose than, for example, state buildings, strictly public facilities. The kinds of projects that I'm talking about that can present concerns of private use for us include stadiums, arenas, other sports facilities, convention centers, business incubators. All of these projects can include private use, which can include naming rights, rented skyboxes in sports facilities, concessions, broadcast rights, advertising, sponsorships, and lease space. Because the state issues tax-exempt bonds for the vast majority of its projects, and because of specifics in state statute that also mean that we have to monitor the use that they're subdivisions of the state, but they're non-state entities, such as municipalities and counties. We also have to monitor the private use to which those facilities are put. And it's very important that we be aware of that private use so that we can monitor it and keep it under the very minimal levels that the IRS will permit in order for our bonds to not become taxable. Because there's a number of projects in the governor's bonding bill that we would consider posing serious private use issues, including the three stadium expansions, civic center expansions that have been considered. He also recommended funding for a project in Austin that would be a public-private partnership. I think it's a business incubator project. We have inserted language into the section of the bonding bill that authorizes MMB to issue bonds, indicating that if at all possible, we will issue tax-exempt bonds, as we have done in the past. Mm. But if need be, we will issue taxable bonds for those projects that we are concerned have so much private use that we cannot issue tax-exempt bonding for.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wicker.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question on that for the proposal you just referred to, or if it was at the university. Do we ever have a provision where if there was a patent and revenue that came from the patent, that the state would share in that if we help fund the facility?
Ms. Grider?
Chairman Sinjim, Senator Wicker, I'm not aware whether we have a provision like that in statute. I do know that to the extent that the state receives money from a private entity, that would exacerbate our private use concerns, because that is actually an instance where the state is receiving, in essence, part of its bonding grant back.
Okay.
Often we're asked how capital projects are actually funded. For example, in 2011, the legislature enacted approximately $500 million bonding bill. MMB does not immediately go out and issue $500 million in bonds. We do that for a couple of reasons. One is that capital appropriations are good, depending on the year that they're enacted. They're good anywhere from 4 to 5 years from the date of enactment, and a number of projects take 1, 2, 4 years to completely get off the ground and to have that money spent. So we do not immediately go out and bond for money that will not be used, say, just in the next year, not only for that reason, because it would generate proceeds that agencies and local governments don't even need to spend yet, but also because it would create problems for us under IRS rules regulating how many bonds we have outstanding and how quickly the proceeds are used. So once a bonding bill has been enacted, agencies and local governments have immediate access to that money. And what we do is we fund those projects out of the general fund until we're ready for our next bond issuance. What we then do is when we're preparing for typically an annual general obligation bond issue is we request agencies to let us know how much money they expect both they and the local governments whose grants they're administering that they will need to spend in the next year. And that's how we size each of our bond issues, so that we're only issuing bonds for the amount of money that we think will be needed for capital projects, say, in the next year or so.
Senator Peterson, do you have a question?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Ms. Grider, is that how you pronounce it?
Grider.
Grider,
thank you.
Sorry, I apologize. Ms. Grider. Relating specifically to those GO bonds, can you give us a sense of what the current interest rate is right now on a bond?
I'm going to let our assistant commissioner answer that question.
Chairman Sinjim, Senator Peterson.
Sanson.
For the record, my name is Kristen Hansen. I'm the assistant commissioner of Treasury at Minnesota Management and Budget. Right now, interest rates at our very favorable from an issuer standpoint. As you know, when we sold our GO bonds in September, we got less than 3% on those. We would probably get something less than that right now. So I would say, you know, below 3%, probably, you know, maybe over 2.5%.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Ms. Hansen, historically, can you give us a sense of where those have been? For example, in the last 5 or 6 years compared to where that is right now?
Senator Sinjim.
Ms. Hansen.
Senator Peterson, I don't have that with me tonight, but I would be happy to prepare that for you and get that to you of historical bond sales and what the average interest rate was on those bonds.
Thank you.
Ms. Hansen, without committing to accuracy, I mean, would they be 3, 4, 5% conceivably, or not that high?
Oh, not that high. They'd be less than 3%.
Okay.
Chairman.
Ms. Grider.
Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else? Senator Hansen, or Senator Nelson, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about the governor's bonding proposal, and I know that you mentioned that I wasn't clear on his priorities. Is there a priority just within the agencies on that first page, or is there a priority overall over the entire bonding request?
Chairman, Senator.
Ms. Grider.
Let me try to make it a bit clearer. There are two pieces that eventually come from the governor's office. The first is his budget recommendation, which was submitted by MMB to the legislature on January 17th. And that, in hard copy, it comes to two binders of information. One of them was tabbed by agency, and each agency has a cover page which shows its requests in priority order from 1 to 3 or 1 to 15, depending on how many requests they had. And then there's an indication of whether the governor recommends funding for them or not. And that cover page is followed by the agency profile, the agency narrative, and a narrative and cost information for each project. The local government binder has similarly got a summary table at the beginning that indicates the amount of requests for each local government. If a local government, for example, the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis had multiple requests, those were given in priority order and then indicated whether he recommended funding for them or not. And then again followed by each in order, alphabetical order, each local government's project narrative request and cost data. Now, his bonding bill does not indicate any priorities like that. It just has a total of $775 million in GO recommendations from the government. Governor.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Sundjum. So I just want to make sure I'm clear. So there is no priority then beyond the priority within the individual agencies. There is no overall priority of the 108 state agency projects. We don't know which one is the top, is the governor's top priority, or which one is in the middle, or which one is the last priority. Is that correct?
Ms. Grider?
Chairman, Senator, that's correct. In fact, we do not make that kind of ranking, and neither does the governor. He just has a list of $775 million worth of GO projects.
Who else? Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Grider, I want to move to the narratives on the specific projects. And looking through them, especially the ones dealing with transportation, I noticed that on the side there is a box or a graph that lists all of the statutory requirements that go along with the provisions of the bonding. Who puts that list of statutory requirements together?
Ms. Grider?
Chairman, Senator, the agencies fill that out, and then I proofread them to make sure they've entered them correctly.
Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Grider, who does the checking to see that those are complete and that all of the statutory requirements are in there and checked off whether they do apply, yes or no? You know, when they list them, they go down and say yes, no, it applies. And are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Oh, Chairman and Senator, I know exactly what you're talking about. And they enter them initially, agencies do, and then I go and as part of our production process, I look at every one of them and make sure they entered them correctly. Okay, and when they didn't, then I go back and change them.
Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Grider, if in the event that there were statutory requirements or policy requirements on the part of MMB that weren't included on that list, what would who would be responsible for ensuring that those additional requirements that aren't on that list are also noted and that the agency understands that there's more that they need to comply with before that project could potentially be funded? through bonding.
Ms. Grider?
Chairman, Senator, we have a number of safeguards and overview procedures in place where we try to make everyone aware of all the statutory and administrative requirements. Those checkoffs in the requests are just one thing that we do. I maintain an ongoing training program with agencies where I have an hour-long presentation where I discuss all the requirements from getting appropriations to entering into grant agreements to supervising projects, oversight, program and project oversight that has to be undertaken both initially and on an ongoing basis. We also have a document called After the Bonding Bill, which we produce after every even year bonding bill, which reiterates many of these requirements that we transmit to agencies and also post on our website.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gimsey.
Ms. Grider, I just wanted to know who we go to in the event that we identify statutes and requirements, including those in MMB's own policy manual governing bonding, that aren't included on that list, so that we're sure when they make a request to us that all of the requirements are fulfilled. Who would we go to if we saw that one or two or three of those aren't being fulfilled or aren't required on that narrative form?
Ms. Grider?
Chairman, Senator, I'm happy to field those requests. That's, in fact, what I do on a daily basis is work with agencies and local governments to make sure they are aware of those. There's one additional piece that I was trying to remember and I couldn't in answer to your previous question. We also keep updated a document called the Capital Grants Manual, which we most recently revised in 2010, which we also make available to agencies and also especially local governments who tend to be, unless they're very large local governments such as the metro cities and counties that are familiar with the grant process, that some of our outstate, well, many of the outstate counties and municipalities are not very familiar with our grant process, and so they need quite a bit of education.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Ryder. Ryder, I'm sorry.
Okay. I don't think I have a lot of slides left, Chairman.
Okay.
I'd like to touch on cancellation of capital appropriations. This is a statutory requirement that encourages both state agencies and local governments who receive appropriations and grants to not sit on their funds too long because they are subject to cancellation if they're not spent. MMB is required by statute to issue a cancellation report on January 1 of every odd-numbered year. So the last cancellation report that we did was on January 1 of 2011. By statute, we are required to list all capital appropriations. Now, that's typically 99% out of the bonding bill, but there's a few general fund capital appropriations as well. We're required to produce a list of all funds in all those appropriations that are more than 4 years old that have been neither spent nor encumbered. Now, what encumbered means is the funds may not have been spent, but the agencies have encumbered a certain amount of the funds in the state accounting system to indicate that they have entered into a contract, and thus these funds will be payable. So for that purpose, we treat those funds as spent, and we do not enter those amounts on our cancellation report because clearly those are funds for which the state will have an obligation to pay in the future. The report that we last did on January 4th of 2011 showed appropriations from the 2006 bonding bill and earlier, and you can see the figures there that it included from bonding appropriations and from general fund appropriations. Now, these amounts are not automatically canceled just by dint of the fact that they have appeared in our cancellation report. The statute provides that those balances will not be canceled, but will in fact be canceled on July 1 of the following year, or no, of the same year. So that cancellation report, those funds were canceled on July 1, 2011, if the legislature did not act during that session to continue them or extend them. Oh, that's That's the end of my presentation. I'll now turn it over to my colleague. Just
Ms. Grider, before you do that, could I just maybe ask a couple? So, maybe going back to slide 5 on page 3, and we don't need lengthy explanations, I don't think. The constitutional requirement is public ownership. I've often wondered, I mean, that's true in certainly this arena, and it is constitutional, but yet we go over to other arenas, say in legacy, and I think we issue money to wildlife organizations and other groups. And is that, there must be some provision somewhere that says, I don't know, the Constitution doesn't prevail in those situations. Is that true?
Chairman, I really, in my position, I can only speak to capital budget.
Okay.
But bonding is specifically governed by Article 11, Section 5 of the Constitution, and not even all bonding money is subject to this requirement. I simplified a bit in that there's a particular section of the Constitution, Article 11, Section 5A, which most of the states' GO bonds are issued under, and that requires public ownership. If you general funds are not subject to that requirement, many other sources of funding are not subject to that requirement. That's a restriction that's pretty much limited to state GO bonding proceeds.
Thank you, Ms. Grider. And that second one, same slide, expenditures which are capital in nature, in other words, that's a requirement. Now, we will find ourselves drifting into studies and pre-designs and things like that. Is there a generally kind of an unclear line as to where we ought to go on things like that? I mean, we will have requests for studies.
Pre-design.
Leading up to a capital expenditure.
That's correct. And, Chairman, that's a very good question, and it's something that I get a lot of questions about on an ongoing basis. We have the benefit of work product that has come out of the Attorney General's office in the past, bond counsel opinions, and at this point we can give a good answer to 90 or 95% of questions that come in. If it's an unusual fact situation, then we ask the Attorney General's office or our tax attorneys. Pre-design is fine. It's typically items that under tax regulations would be considered capital expenditures. So pre-design for a building that has already been sited can be the subject of bond proceeds. We call that a bondable project, meaning it bond proceeds can be used for it. Master studies cannot. Feasibility studies that an agency might undertake to determine whether they want to do a project at all, that's not bondable because a project has not been identified and sited. But once a project has been identified and is in the process, what I should say is once there is a project identified, then most of the preparatory work for that is bondable. Pre-design, site corrections, pollution and contamination remediation, all of that is bondable.
Anyone else? Thank you, Ms. Grider, and you will stand by, I suspect. And next, to go into the debt management practices for the state of Minnesota, Ms. Christine Hansen.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm going to talk about not only the debt management practices of MMB, but I'm also going to provide an overview about municipal bonds, and you have in your handout as well as in this PowerPoint a basic definition of a bond. And I know some of this is very basic, but it helps for a context of all of the things we're going to be talking about.
So are we, or at least so am I. Very basic.
I live and breathe municipal bonds, but not everybody does. Municipal bonds are debt securities that are issued by states, cities, counties, and other governmental entities to finance capital projects, which Gay has touched on, such as buildings, schools, highways, sewer systems, and in some cases to fund day-to-day obligations. And the issuer, in this case the state, agrees to pay interest and the return on the investment, which is the principal amount, to the bondholders who have loaned the issuer money for those projects. And oftentimes in the bond world, we liken municipal bonds to mortgages, just as a back kind of a context that people are familiar with. The authority under which the state issues its bonds determines not only the type of bond issue, but what kind of restrictions that we have to follow, and Gay has mentioned some of those. But we are, you know, directed by the state constitution. We are guided by Minnesota statutes, 16A, but in specific cases of other types of bonds that have been issued by other agencies, that is specifically identified in statute. And we also are kind of regulated by different federal regulations, the IRS, importantly, and also the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board. Slide 6 shows the state bond issuers. So not only does MMB, the commissioner of MMB, issue the GO various purpose and trunk highway bonds, as well as certain revenue bonds, there are other authorities within the state that has statutory authority to issue debt. And kind of in the spirit of time, you have that list in front of you. There are other types of state obligations where the state has standing appropriations, and you're familiar with the University of Minnesota. They have issued bonds, and the state has appropriated a portion of that debt service payment, including their stadium as well as the biomedical science buildings. Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has issued bonds where there is a state appropriation, and the certificates of participation, which were issued to finance the SWIFT project, and the integrated tax software, are state standing appropriations. We also have entered into lease purchase financing for equipment. We have a master lease agreement to fund computer equipment as well as vehicles. And there's the lease purchase financing for real estate. The St. Paul Port Authority issued those leases to finance the Freeman and Anderson buildings. And then there are two other programs that are state obligations. You may have heard of the school district credit enhancement program, as well as the county and city credit enhancement program. We are not paying their debt, but we are enhancing their debt, which means that should they not be able to make their payments on the debt, the state would step in and make those payments for them. However, it's not free money. We would withhold their state aid, and it's for their general obligation debt. So it's pretty strong debt that the school districts and cities and counties are issuing, where they're pledging their own taxing power. Slide 6 just shows the current amount of state obligations outstanding, and since I actually worked on this PowerPoint, I'm projecting where it's going to be 3 days from now, on the 16th instead of today. Most bonds get paid on the first of the month, so it's this shows what the outstanding debt is. All of the state's GO debt, including various purpose and trunk highway, is about $5.43 billion, and that number will change as of the February forecast. Those numbers are not yet available, but it shows the outstanding debt of the various authorities that also have the power to issue, the authority to issue debt. There are a number of different types of bonds. The two most common are general obligation bonds, which are backed by the full faith and credit of the issuer. In our case, it would be the state. And then also revenue bonds, which are backed by a specific revenue stream. The state's 911 bonds are backed by that 911 fee to make those payments. The bonds can be issued as tax-exempt or taxable, regardless of if they're GOs or another type of bond, a revenue bond, a lease purchase. Bonds can be issued as fixed rate, which is how our GOs are sold, how our 911 bonds were sold, and variable rate debt. And currently, we at MMB do not have the authority to issue variable rate debt. And bonds can be long-term or short-term. And our state constitution says our GO bonds can be no more than 20 years in length. I am going to, slide 8 talks about what projects are eligible for GO bond financing. Thus, part of the Constitution is mentioned here, but Gay did talk about that in length in her presentation. And the next slide does show other purposes for which GO debt may be issued, but I'm not going to walk through all of those pieces at this point in time. Some of the important provisions that relate to our GO bonds, since that is the majority of bonds that the state itself issues, it's a full faith and credit obligation of the state, which means that if we don't have enough money to make the bond payments, we do have the ability to levy a tax on state taxpayers if necessary to meet its debt service obligations. I mentioned earlier that the maximum length is 20 years. Each bond issue must distinctly specify the purposes and a maximum amount of the proceeds authorized to be extended. And we have a list in our official statement, which is the document that goes out to the underwriting community, pages, single-spaced, of what all those authorizations are. And then a special and separate state bond fund is maintained for debt service. And then we also do have a separate fund for bond proceeds for a reporting and accounting requirement. And another feature for the state's GO bonds is that when we make the debt service transfer by December 1st of each year, we are transferring 19 months' worth of payments, not just a year's worth, and rating agencies do look favorable on that. They look favorable on our debt management practices. Something that we get asked a lot of questions about is our capital investment guidelines. And several years ago, those were changed. There used to be that 3% that you all probably are very familiar with, but we changed those guidelines in 2009 to more align with how the rating agencies look at our debt limits. And so these are the three guidelines, and you should also have a copy of, this is the November debt capacity forecast, which has a lot of numbers and restates what I'm going to talk about. So our guideline one says the total tax-supported principal outstanding, which means these are bonds that have actually been issued, shall be 3.25% or less of the total state personal income. And as of the November forecast, our total principal outstanding was $5.963 billion, which was 2.45% of the state personal income. Now, the tax-supported debt includes the GOs, but also it includes some of those other bonds that I mentioned, the MHFA housing bonds, because there's that state appropriation, the University of Minnesota bonds, and so anything that is coming out of the general fund is considered tax-supported debt from our guideline one, as well as how the rating agencies view that. So under guideline one, the remaining principal capacity is about $1.96 billion. This is a guideline. It's not necessarily what's affordable. And that becomes a policy question that you have to discuss when you're looking at what size of a bonding bill that you might be considering. Guideline two is the total amount of principal, not only what has already been issued, but what is authorized and unissued. So in the summer, when the 2011 bonding bill was passed, as Gay indicated, we don't issue all of those bonds all at once. We actually have an estimated payment schedule that we use for the forecasts. And so in an odd number year, we assume 20% of those bonds will be issued, and then 55% in the next year and 25% in year three. So those authorized but unissued are not included in guideline one, but they're included in guideline two. And that still includes those same category of bonds, those tax-supported bonds, which include our GOs, as well as our leases and some of the other appropriation bonds that I discussed. And that shall not exceed 6% of the total state personal income. And as of November 2011, that total amount of issued and authorized but not yet issued was just over $8 billion. And the maximum principal capacity was over $3 billion. The revenue bonds I had mentioned, the 911 bonds, those are not accounted for in these guidelines because those are supported by revenue and they're not considered tax-supported debt. Guideline 3 talks about how fast we mature our bonds, and RGO bonds are sold with level principal, so not level principal and interest, so our annual payments are not level. We actually retire the principal quicker, and we look that 40% of the GO bonds are to mature within 5 years and 70% within 10 years.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, thank you very much. As it pertains to Guideline 3, are there provisions in some of these bonds that we can call them or refinance them?
Yes.
In other words, now we're looking at 2.25%, 2.5%, and somewhere out there at 5-6. Can we call them?
Yes.
And redo them and save the taxpayers a lot of money?
Ms. Hanson.
And are you doing that?
Chairman, Senator Metzen, yes, we do that. We continually monitor the opportunities for refunding bonds. Right now, the interest rates are very low, as I had indicated earlier. But what is also very low are the investment rates. So when we sell refunding bonds, most of them are considered advanced refunding bonds where we're selling them years before their call date, and a call date or redemption feature basically says what bonds can be refinanced or call at what time and at what price. And so what we're seeing, and this is going to get into the weeds, and I am a bond nerd.
a lot of nerds up here might understand that.
So to fund the escrow, we have to put in more proceeds to make sure that we have enough money to pay, when the bonds are callable, to make that payment, to refund them. And so there's a lot of what's called negative arbitrage. Most of you have heard of positive arbitrage, where you borrow at a low interest rate and you invest at a higher rate, and that's called positive arbitrage, and IRS doesn't like that so much. But negative arbitrage is the opposite of that, where you're borrowing at a rate, but the investment rates are lower, and so you have to make it whole. And so right now we're seeing a lot of negative arbitrage on the refundings, and I'll get into – I have a slide talking about some of our internal guidelines for refundings that will address some of the other pieces. But we continually monitor the ability to do refundings, and also the underwriting community does the same because they would all like to work for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, anything else?
No.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Remind me again who made these guidelines.
This was done in 2009, and it was I wasn't here then, but it was the assistant commissioner at that time working with our financial advisor, and the commissioner worked to establish these. Prior to that, it was that 3% guideline, and we were getting awfully close to that, and it was based on kind of general fund revenues, and as those changed, that number would change. And now this is based on our total personal income.
So is it the intent then to apply all three guidelines to a bonding bill, or is it the intent that one guideline would be sufficient or another guideline?
We look at when, Chairman, Senator, we look at all three. When it comes to GO bonds, we look at it in the context of all three of these guidelines.
And just so I understand this, under guideline number one, am I reading that incorrectly to say that we have the capacity for a $1.96 billion bonding bill this year, or am I reading that incorrectly?
Ms. Hanson.
Chairman, Senator, theoretically you could do that. But
I realize theoretically we can do just about anything we want, but is that what that is saying?
You have the ability to have, Chairman, sure. Senator, you have the ability to have an additional $1.9 billion in outstanding debt. Probably guideline 2 is going to be more crucial because if you pass a $775 million bonding bill, just using that number, is that it's going to be the amount issued as well as authorized and unissued, and so that's going to eat up on guideline 2. So technically you could, but you have to look into the future too, because you're going to have future bond issues that are going to affect those guidelines 1 and 2 as well. And so you can't really just operate and say, let's just use up the, you know, authority or our guidelines now and then, you know, leave no flexibility into the future.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Senator Tomasoni.
Just out of curiosity, the guidelines are there for, obviously, to guide us, but are they to send a signal to the financial markets, or are they to send a signal to people who buy the bonds? What's the actual reason for the guidelines?
Chairman, Senator.
Ms. Hanston.
These guidelines are tied to some of the indicators that the rating agencies look at for bond ratings. They look at our amount of debt outstanding. They look at our debt management practices. They look at how fast we spend our bond proceeds. And so they are, in fact, indicators that the rating agencies look at, which the investors will look at on how they're going to price the bonds.
Mr. Chairman, one final question. Do the rating,
Senator Tomasoni.
Do the rating agencies have their own guidelines, or do they just look at the state and see how they operate?
Ms. Hanson.
Chairman, Senator, the rating agencies do a very careful analysis. They will put together their own numbers. They will look at specifics of, in our official statement, they will put together their own indicators, but they also, you know, look at management practices. That's what the rating agencies, that's a piece that they look at, one of the components that they can see that an issuer has control over. There are obviously things that issuers do not have, you know, control over, and that's things happening in the economy. But this is something that they can see what issuers are doing. And so they look to see, you know, how we're meeting those, how much debt burden we have. And so that is part of the analysis that a rating agency looks at.
I just came up with one last point.
Senator Tomasoni, you're doing well.
And is that, let me see here, is the 3.25% or less of total state personal income, is that the figure that I've seen where Minnesota is like at 47th in the country?
Ms. Hanson.
Senator Senjum, Senator, I would have to look into that. I don't have that answer with me this evening.
Are we really low on the list, though? Do you know that?
I've
heard Senator Langseth say things like, "How about if we're 35th? Wouldn't that be okay?" You know, as opposed to 47th. But so I'm just wondering if we're really low on the list.
Chairman, Senator,
Ms. Hanson.
There are a number of indices that rating agencies look at and compare us to. The rating agencies do come out with different rankings on, you know, debt capacity per, you know, debt outstanding per person, things like that. We can get you some indices to show where we are in different categories, but I don't have those with me this evening.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langset.
Mr. Chair, it was 43rd, not 47th, so we're much higher than you talked about. But, you know, one of the reasons that they changed the guidelines was that when our administration would go to talk to the bond companies, they kind of disregarded this 3%. That wasn't what they were interested in. They were interested in more of what the guidelines now say, and that's what they were going by. So that's one of the reasons that the guidelines were changed, to more fit what the bond companies themselves would look at as to what our bond rating should be and so on.
Was there another one over here?
I had a question.
Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, too, is also about this change in guidelines. Certainly, for the longest time, we were all familiar with the 3% of 3% of the general fund for debt payments. But now with these new guidelines, I was kind of listening as you were talking about the change, and I think it was maybe between the two of you. One item I caught was that we were bumping up towards the cap, and so it was important that we change the guidelines. And then also later, though, it was said that, you know, it's because the bond houses have a different way of evaluating. And it's interesting that it looks like guideline 1 and 2, in a sense, both are related to a percent of total personal or state income, total mm-hmm. personal income. And I'm just curious, because I'm thinking that may fluctuate significantly, and yet the bonds that we're taking out are 20-year bonds. Are other states also looking at guidelines based upon total state personal income? And is this one of the criteria that the rating houses look at?
Ms. Hanson.
Chairman, Senator, as was indicated earlier, this is definitely one of the pieces that the rating agencies look at. And, you know, states have different debt guidelines, and I'm not familiar with all of them. And I'm new enough that I'm very familiar with these and not the 3%. But, yes, the state's personal income does change, which will affect what these percentages are. And as you know, we do, you know, we issue bonds, but we also pay them off, and so those numbers will change as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Hanson, I have a question. Going back to page 3 and slide 6, where we've got, you know, current amounts of state obligations outstanding, in other words, debt, and I don't know, I'm just going to guess that totals up to $7 billion. If it doesn't, why, it's in that neighborhood. And then you go to guideline number 1. Are you suggesting on top of what I'm just calling $7 billion of current debt, we could add nearly $2 billion more and still be kind of okay from the standpoint of debt management and affordability?
In regards, Chairman.
I'm sorry, Ms. Hanson.
In regards to the question of the outstanding debt, the state under our guidelines, yes, could currently issue an additional $1.9 billion in debt and still fall within guideline 1. In terms of affordability, this is kind of a threshold that the rating agencies look like in terms of, you know, debt management, you know, guidelines. They also look at the amount of debt we have outstanding and other factors that all contribute to what our rating is going to be. In terms of kind of an affordability criteria, that is a policy decision on what the legislature deems is affordable. But these are some pieces that the rating agencies look at. There are other factors that the rating agencies do look at, as you heard during the two downgrades that we experienced in 2011, on what some of those factors were.
Okay. Anyone else? If not, you can carry on, Ms. Hanson.
So if we move along to the next slide, the informal debt policies and practices. As you know, you've seen and heard about our kind of debt management guidelines, the 3 that come up, and they're part of the debt capacity forecast that's issued when we do our economic forecast. But there are other kind of informal policies and practices that MMB has to kind of protect the state. We have established post-issuance compliance policies and procedures. Some history is that the IRS in the last several years has increased their tax-exempt bond division. In 2010, they doubled the number of agents that are looking at tax-exempt debt. Some of the initial questionnaires went out to nonprofits. They went out to issuers that issued Build America bonds. That was part of the ARRA program. But they are increasingly looking at tax-exempt borrowers to make sure we're following the rules. And so as part of, you know, the state, you know, paying attention to kind of what they're paying attention to, Gay indicated a lot of the due diligence that she does on the behalf of the state. We've now established these policies and procedures, which will be shared with the agencies and the local governments, so they're aware of what we need to do. I, in fact, have a contact at the IRS that they send me information, and if I have any questions. So they have really, you know, ramped up what they're doing in terms of questionnaires, audits, examinations. We also have refunding criteria. You know, the question came up about, you know, monitoring for refundings. For decades, the policy has been that we would make sure that we have a 5% present value savings overall on the bond issue and a 3% savings by maturity. This is kind of common practice recommended by the Government Finance Officers Association. In my past life, when I was in the private sector as a financial advisor, this is what we also recommended to our clients so that issuers weren't doing what we call marginal refundings, and they were, you know, we wanted to make sure that the issuer was benefiting from the refunding and not the consultants. We have the ability to do competitive and negotiated sales. Our practice has been to do competitive sales. We are, our GOs are very well regarded in the market, but there have been times where the credit market has closed up and we needed, you know, to access the market, and that ability to negotiate has provided that flexibility of capital access when we need that. We have issues about timing of bond sales. As you know, we've talked about interest rates being very favorable right now. You know, why aren't we in the market right now? We need to kind of time bond issues so that there aren't any significant issues that could actually affect the security of the bonds. So we actually, as you know, we have the February forecast coming out. After that forecast comes out, we don't sell bonds until at least 25 days after that. And we typically do not sell during session because there's sometimes a little bit of uncertainty on what that outcome is going to be and how that might affect the bonds. And so there's a number of things that we actually, you know, consider in the timing of bonds to make sure that we are being good fiduciaries for the state's bond issues. Bond ratings. We've talked a little bit about that.
Senator Kubley had a question.
You mentioned we pay off our bonds early. Is that true, regardless of the number of years for which the bonds are issued?
Ms. Hansen.
Senator, in response to your question, we pay off the bonds within 20 years, but it's level principal, so we pay them off, not necessarily early, but we pay them off in a more timely fashion than some issuers. A lot of bond issues are issued as level principal and interest payments and not level principal. And so we're paying off the bonds sooner than perhaps some other issues, and that's looked upon favorably by the rating agencies. When we do a refunding, we are typically refinancing existing maturity, so we're not necessarily changing the term of the bonds. We're definitely not extending them, but we do issue the bonds so that the maturity schedule matches. In my past life, we would do analysis for clients on what happens if you shorten it by a year. You know, are you going to save money? And what usually happens is that the annual debt service payments are usually more. I mean, obviously, the present value savings would be more, but your the actual payments are higher than they were previously, and some of the discussions that we have in terms of length of bond issues, it's the same thing about home mortgage, where obviously the shorter the issue, the lower the interest rate, the longer the issue, the higher the interest rate. We have seen bonds go out, you know, 30 years, but you're going to pay a higher interest cost, but a lower annual payment. But yes, we're not really shortening the issue, but we're paying it off sooner than if it was level principal and interest.
Okay. Thank you. Carry on, Ms. Hansen.
Bond ratings. Bonds may be rated by one or more of the three major credit rating agencies, and as you know, our GO bonds are rated by all three of them, Fitch Ratings, Moody's Investors Service, and Standard & Poor's. And a bond rating is a measure of risk to the bondholders or the investors. AAA is the highest rating. D bonds are in default. And then, you know, depending on where you fall in between the A's and the D's, some are considered junk rating if you're in the C and lower B categories. Obviously, the higher the credit rating, the lower the risk to the investor, as well as the lower the interest rate. And general obligation bonds carry the lower interest rates because you are pledging you know, in our case, the state's taxing power. We're pledging our full faith and credit behind those bonds, and that's a good guarantee to the bond holders. It's the lowest form of borrowing that you can actually do. Currently, for our state's GO bonds, we have a AA plus with Fitch, a AA1 with Moody's, and with S&P, we have a AA plus, so we're a pure AA. The 911 revenue bonds carry a AA rating from Fitch, a AA3 rating from Moody's, and a AA plus from S&P. And in regards, I put together some statistics. There are 9 states that currently have a pure AAA rating, where they're rated AAA by all 3 rating agencies. There's 9 of those. There are 6 states that have at least 2 AAA ratings. There are 3 states that are less than kind of a AA3, single A, and we fall in the middle of all of those. Some of the federal considerations that we have to make and be mindful of, and Gay has mentioned this, is the tax-exempt status of bonds. As I indicated, the IRS is looking more carefully at that at this point in time. Arbitrage, I had mentioned that. It's basically earning money on borrowed money. We follow the 18-month spending exception, so we make sure that we're spending the bond proceeds within 18 months so that we are not subject to arbitrage. At this point in time, given the interest rate environment, there is not a lot of arbitrage to be earned, but those times those times will change, and the IRS looks at reporting from a 5-year standpoint. Disclosure, we are required by the SEC Rule 15C212, which was passed in 1995 after the Orange County fiasco. We do annual disclosure to the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board on our bonds on kind of just annual updating our information. But in addition, we have to do what are called material event notices if something happens, like a rating downgrade. So we had to notify and publish that on a system called EMMA so that the investors knew about the downgrade. And then, as I've indicated before, you have this new enforcement component of the IRS looking at the tax-exempt bonds. And at this point, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any taxable bonds out there now that we've listed, Ms. Commissioner Hansen?
Chairman, Senator. yes, we do. We actually issue taxable bonds for the Rural Finance Authority because those that program is giving money to individuals, so it's not a public entity. So, yes, we do.
Senator Magnus?
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, we have different interest rates on those, whether they're taxable or tax-exempt.
Ms. Hansen.
Chairman, Senator. Yes, the rates on the taxable bonds are slightly higher. Right now, rates, there are times when you can see a difference of taxable versus tax-exempt as high as 2%. It's much closer now. But when we do issue the RFA taxable component, we actually issue those as 5-year bonds. And so, you know, it's a 5-year maturity versus a 20-year maturity. So we're not necessarily comparing apples to oranges. But traditionally, taxable bonds do have a higher interest rate. But right now, the taxable market is very favorable as well.
Senator Magnus?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Hansen. How about a stadium? If we issued bonds for a new stadium here, would those be tax exempt or would those be taxable?
Ms. Hansen,
Senator, it's going to depend on that lease and use agreement between the state and the Vikings. And I've not done any. I'm not an attorney, so there's been no legal analysis done. But at this point in time, there will be a lot of components that would need to be looked at. And, you know, you'd hope that we'd be able to, you know, issue some of them as tax-exempt. But, you know, that analysis would have to be done by tax counsel.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks,
Senator Magnus. Is that an announcement or?
No, I'm trying to think how we're going to get, you know, get this done here for the governor this year. I want to get that done.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hansen, this may be a silly question, but I'm a freshman, so I'll probably get one for that. In the unlikely event that a general obligation bond, that we would default on that, and they're backed by the ability of the state government to raise taxes to pay that back, am I correct? That was...
Mm-hmm.
Who has that authority? Is that the administration, or is that a legislative authority?
Ms. Hansen.
Chairman, Senator, it's actually in... it's in statute and the state auditor. Before we would ever default, if we knew we weren't going to be able to make the payment, and as I indicated before, we make that transfer from the general fund to the debt service fund. We do that 19-month transfer. That's to allow for time that if we know that we're not going to have funds available to make that debt service payment, that we would levy that tax. It would be the state auditor to collect the funds to make those payments. So technically, we would not be in default because of that feature.
Senator Carlson.
I think you missed my question. The we, it sounded like you could do that administratively?
No, the state auditor would have to do that.
Right. So they can bypass the legislature and raise taxes to do that?
Ms. Hansen.
Chairman, Senator, it's in statute that we have the ability to do that, as well as I do believe it's in the state constitution. So.
It's never happened.
An amendment?
Oh, no.
Okay, anyone else? This is a golden moment now. We don't get these people all the time. Senator Gimsey.
It is a golden moment, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I am trying to get my head around a number of projects that we're seeing come forward in the request, they're requesting so much this biennium with additional appropriations in the next biennium, and the dollars that are being used are going to be for, say, the pre-planning, the pre-design, environmental studies, that type of thing. Who monitors how those dollars are spent and whether, it seems to me it's pure speculation that the next appropriation would be coming in the next bonding cycle. And is there somebody that's watching out for these dollars that are being spent and ensuring that projects that may never get funding, may never receive the non-state sources and other dollars that would make the project complete? I have a very major concern because the numbers I'm seeing are huge. They're in the tens of millions of dollars. I just have a concern about we can't bind future legislatures to appropriate the additional dollars that they're going to be requesting in the next biennium. Who's monitoring this, and how are we dealing with the fact that we could be spending money that on projects that never come to fruition?
Ms. Hansen or Ms. Ryder?
Chairman, Senator Gimsey, I'll take that one. There's a number of safeguards in place. I will answer your question. If I don't get to what it is you're asking for, then reword your question. But I think based on what I'm hearing you ask, it's a rule of statutory interpretation. It's also under our full funding requirement that every project that is approved for funding, and this is the sort of thing that we monitor during session. I look for it in the bonding bill that I work on for the governor for his recommendation. We try to monitor all the bonding bill pieces that are going through the House and Senate. We monitor what comes out of conference committee, the side-by-side. We keep bond counsel closely informed. Is every project that is in any bonding bill must be a self-contained project on its own. Now, if it's a pre-design for a building, we understand that that building may never be constructed. But that's all right. The whole point of a pre-design is to suss out all the specs for the building, all the costs, and determine if it's feasible or not. And we understand we're taking a risk that if we fund pre-design, that it may, the building itself may never get completed. Now, for multi-year projects such as major transit projects where you're 90% of it could end up being, the capital costs could end up being funded through the federal government, for example. We require that whatever component of that project is funded in any given bonding appropriation must be a self-contained project on its own, whether it's pre-design, site development, site corrections, a component part, for example, of a transit project, such as a segment of a rail line or a station, that it must be a project that makes sense on its own and that you're not just building a highway to nowhere. That's part of the oversight that we engage in during the bonding session, and occasionally we realize it even after something has been enacted, and then we have to advise the either the agency or the local government that they have to go back and get their rider amended because basically they got an appropriation for a quarter of a project, and the project doesn't make sense if that's the only piece of it that's constructed. The other thing we do goes back to that full funding requirement that I mentioned earlier, that before the state releases any money, it will go ahead and enter into a grant agreement with a local government, for example. But the money will not actually be made available to the local government until they have furnished proof that they have all of the matching funding and other funding required, whether it was a specific match in the rider or not. If it's additional funding that they need to complete, that they need to make available based on the total project budget, we make sure that all of that is in place before we disperse any of the state funding. So those are the safeguards that we have in place.
Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Grider. Shortly after becoming chair of the Transportation Committee, I became aware of a project that was ongoing and had received bonding funding on a couple of different occasions through different bonding bills, and became aware that the federal money had been appropriated or allocated but never appropriated, and that the full funding agreement to the tune of $450 million was not secured by the actual full funding agreement with the federal government. Can you see what I'm trying to get my head around here is when I ask the question, well, who's going to be, and by the way, $100 million of state money had been spent. When I asked, well, what happened, you know, where's the 10% we put toward that particular project, well, that had been spent. And so the money had been appropriated before the federal full funding agreements were in place, and the money was flowing from the federal government. I guess I'm still lacking the confidence that we have either the procedures, or am I missing something in that, you know, it's in my concern that state dollars are becoming first in, first spent on some of these projects, and the possibility that those full funding agreements, especially given the situation with the federal government now, that those dollars may never come. How can that happen?
Chairman, Senator Gibson, I totally understand what you're talking about, and I understand the concern. I would need to see understand the exact facts of the project you're describing. Many times, for example, on transit projects, I'm thinking of a number of the ones that I'm more familiar with and have looked at recently have been planning dollars, and so the big federal bucks are coming down the road, but the agency does not need to actually have the construction dollars in hand in order to complete, for example, a pre-design component of a project. it is absolutely our intent that the state dollars not be the first dollars out, and just hoping that everybody else's money comes along. That's why we have the full funding requirement. Depending on how the project is defined, what the budget was that was in the grant agreement, if this was going to a local government, we try to be and we try to make agencies very aware of how what the project is that's described in the bonding legislation, that through our oversight during the legislative process that riders are not getting enacted for a much broader project scope than anybody thinks the money is going to be coming in the next couple of years, because the state money is not supposed to be dispersed until all of the funding is at least in place. It doesn't have to be in hand, but there has to be, for example, a full funding agreement with feds. There has to be line items in budgets from other local governments that are contributing. So what you're describing could be a problematic situation. I would need to look at the facts of that, and I'd be happy to discuss that.
Well,
Senator Gimsey.
Just one more of a comment than a question, and I guess it's probably for the committee as we move forward. We currently have a situation where we have a full funding agreement with the federal government for a significant amount of money that the agreements were signed months ago, and there still is no, as far as I know, no federal money flowing to the state of Minnesota. So, you know, we have to, I believe, be very cautious when we take the word of the federal government that those dollars are going to be coming to us, and we're making these rather large appropriations and bonding authorizations into some of these projects. I intend to exercise caution going forward. So just so the committee knows that, we'll be dealing with some transportation projects, and just want folks here to understand that that's probably going to be the case from my perspective. That'll be in this bill
anyway. Thank you, Senator Gimsey. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hansen, I want to go back to your handout, State Debt Management Practices, page 5, slide 10. I just want to make sure I understood your response to Senator Carlson's question. The first bullet point, a full faith and credit obligation of the state. State will levy a tax if necessary to meet its debt service obligations. Did you say the state auditor has that authority to raise the taxes? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Senator Metzen, did you have a question over here?
Okay. I might have over here, though.
We'll think about it for a while. Anyone else? This is a special time now. You're not going to get these people here. Well, they probably will be here with some regularity, but okay.
We know where they live. We'll go get them again.
Right, okay. Well, if there's no other questions then, the committee will stand adjourned until 8:30 on Wednesday, and at that point we will hear from the University of Minnesota. We'll hear about libraries. We'll hear about state academies. We'll hear about the Pripyat School of the Arts. And if there's nothing else, we stand adjourned until Wednesday at 8:30 at the same location.
You, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He didn't mention Minsky. He just said the University. Well, I'm sure.
Okay. Okay. They did a wonderful job.
Oh, I got my car. Oh.